Good afternoon, everyone. This is Wednesday, May 27th. We are in the Senate Committee on Healthcare. And I would like to open, first of all, I want to let everyone know we're carrying over 2638. So if you're here for 2638, you can leave. I think everything else we will be working. With that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3530. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3530A prohibits specified terms imposed on vision care providers by vision care insurance or vision care discount cards. There's a dash A2 amendment which specifies the discount cards do not include discount medical plans. Dash A3 amendment, which requires that the contract between vision care providers and the entity that offers vision care insurance or discount cards may not restrict or limit the vision care provider's choice of suppliers or materials. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Great. Representative Hoyle and Representative Widener.
This is something you're not going to see very often.
I know. I was just giving him grief about voting against my other bill.
I didn't do that. Not me.
Oh. Madam Chair, members of the committee, State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, encompassing most of Yamhill County and parts of Southwest Washington County, or large rural part of Washington County. So I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 3530, which is the good representative Hoyle's bill that she proposed for one of her constituents and everything. And it's something that I'm tied to pretty heavily with the manufacturing of frames and lenses. It's an industry that a friend of mine who was an OD had me get into this business with him and another partner, and we opened up a lens manufacturing lab. He talked about a lot of the issues and stuff that they ran into with the manufacturing of lenses, frames, things like that as a doctor and an OD trying to get quality products for his patients, and how he was being forced in to get an inferior products and issues like that. And he wanted to actually develop something where patients could get the highest quality lens at the best price out there on the market. Well, so we got going and ordered millions of dollars worth of equipment and brought in is we ran into that there were vision plans, or calling themselves vision plans or insurance, that were out there collecting premiums from the patient, and then they were actually dictating or telling the doctor what to prescribe to the patient and forcing them into their own labs or into their own frames. And it got to where right now there is only, that I know of, one independent lab left. Every other one has been forced out of business or shut down because they were unable to do business with doctors because they would come in and they would be carrying one of these plans. But is what you have is this provider, plan provider, owns their own lab. They own their own frame company. So they're collecting premiums over here from the patient or from us as the consumer. While they're collecting that premium, we go to the doctor, and the doctor has to buy their frames from this insurance company provider. There'll be a multitude of companies that they own. They'll have to buy the frames from them that they pay $10, sell them to the doctor for $60. Well, then they had discount cards on top of that, so the doctor would have to mark these frames up to $250 in case they walked in with the discount card to give them 40% off. So is what happens is they just basically are collecting money in every aspect, from the frames to the lenses and the plan or the premium. Then you go in and you pay all your copays. If you want to get a decent lens where you actually have AR coatings and things like that on it, now you have copays. Well, they also take part of the copays back from the doctor as well. So there's not really any cash out layer. It's not really an insurance policy. It's basically a plan where they just collect money over and over, and they force the doctors to have to use them for being a provider on their system. So essentially is what we're doing with House Bill 3530 is allowing the doctor and the patient to sit down and decide what's best for the patient, to have the conversation, what lens design works best for your daily activities. Do you drive a lot? What is it that you do every day? Because some patients might need a soft design lens, some might need a hard design, or different design in their lens. Patients will be allergic to different frames. I found it weird. I couldn't believe it, and I would have laughed if anybody told me this. But there was one of the places that we worked with. We redid lenses for them because their patient had an allergic outbreak to a set of frames that they had bought. So they loved the lens design that was there. Sometimes it's the lens needs to be changed. So a doctor needs that flexibility to be able to work with a patient, just like a medical doctor needs flexibility on what he prescribes for a patient medically out of a hospital, because he might be allergic to amoxicillin, but he's not allergic to penicillin or whatever other type of drug there is. And that's essentially what we're doing. And we brought the Dash A3 amendments back, which basically is what they say is that the insurance company or provider, plan provider, cannot directly or indirectly restrict or limit a vision care provider's choice of supplier or materials. So they can go to their labs, but they might have a patient where they want to use something else, because it could be turnaround time too, where we've had cases where a patient needs something right away. When they're forcing into their own labs, sometimes it takes a month, 2 months to get a set of glasses back from these places, and they're all going out of state. They're either Olympia, Washington, they're coming out of China, different places that they're bringing the lenses in. So this is basically just allowing doctors and patients some flexibility and choice to give the best outcomes for the patient, and that's what House Bill 3530 does. It'll be interesting to see what the comments would be in opposition to this, but this is definitely something where consumers are getting killed, where doctors are being hurt and barely able to keep their offices open in some points because they're being forced to the bottom common denominator rather than looking at the best outcomes for a patient. So with that, I will end my testimony and turn it over to Representative Hoyle. I will say after this bill passed the House and this was taken out, the materials piece that we're looking to put back in, a letter went out to Hoya, who is Essler, a large company, saying they wouldn't accept their lens designs, and Hoya employs a lot of people in Oregon, and this would be something that would hurt them, where they would probably look at laying people off in the state as well. So we're seeing a lot of companies being ran out of the state because of this.
Thank you. Val Hoyle, representative from District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. So this bill, I put this bill forward at the request of a constituent, Rainbow Optics, where they have optometrists, they sell glasses and contacts, and they also have a lab where they make frames and glasses. So for myself, I can't see without my glasses. Being able to go to somewhere locally where they can respond if my glasses break, if I want a certain type of glass, is really helpful. The other thing is they employ people in my district, in my neighborhood. So these are local jobs. I choose to go there, and if I have a vision benefit, say $70 for lenses, I should be able to choose where I spend that $70. I will choose to spend my money locally to employ Oregonians. The base bill basically says that a vision plan cannot require the optometrist to give a discount on glasses or sunglasses or even contact lenses that are not provided by the vision plan. Because you have vision plans, who as Representative Widener says, where they have their own manufacturing facility, they make their own glasses or provide their own contact lenses. They were also requiring that optometrists would give a discount even on products that they don't supply. And that just seems, didn't seem logical, so we passed this bill. We also wanted a separate segment, which is, you will see in the Dash 3 amendments. And the Dash 3 amendments say, not only can you not tell someone that they have to provide a discount on something that, again, the vision care provider doesn't provide, which makes sense in a free market, but also If they're going to provide a certain benefit, that benefit should be able to use whether or not the product is bought from the company or is bought from the optometrist. So whether it's bought locally or it's, again, provided through the vision care plan. If you have a vision care plan that is taking copays, providing the product, taking that profit, it seems very circular. For me, what I found most compelling and why we decided to put forward the A3 amendments, and thank you for allowing us to do that and for hearing the amendments, was the letter that went out to Hoya. They employ about 200 people in Oregon, and as soon as we passed the underlying bill, that letter went out, and those are real jobs right here in Oregon. So I think this is about fairness. I think this is about transparency. I think this is about people being able to use a benefit for the vision plans that they sign up for. And it doesn't mean that a vision plan can't provide a product. It just means that they have to give the option that we could have, again, local choice and local service. So I would urge passage of this bill. I would hope you'd be able to support this with the A3 amendment.
Thank you. Questions? There is one other amendment, the A2s, and I'd like John Powell to come up while you two are still here and let him propose his and just see what your reaction is to that.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing the Consumer Health Alliance, and we brought forward the Dash A2 amendment that is before your committee today and on OLIS. To clarify the definition of discount cards in the bill that passed the House. The Consumer Health Alliance is a trade association for discount medical plan organizations, which are licensed and regulated in Oregon under ORS 742.420. The bill appears focused on issues relating to conflicts of contract between vision insurers and eye doctors. Discount medical plans in Oregon are not insurance, and they're not tied to insurance. And so we are asking that discount medical plan organizations not be included in the definition of discount cards. We have met with the Oregon Optometric Association. They are okay with the amendment. These plans are not the target of the bill. They do not have problems with our plans. And we would ask that the A2 amendment be adopted. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that seems very reasonable to me.
Madam Chair, I actually did get a chance to look at the A2s, and yeah, I see no issue with them. I could see where it would be something like AARP, groups like that would have discount cards similar to what Mr. Powell is talking about, and I'm supportive of the A2s and don't have a problem adopting those with this as well. So,
all right. Well, we don't have we do on no. Both of them? No, never mind. Okay. All right. We'll hear from the rest of the people who want to testify, and then may or may not pass the bill today.
Fantastic. Okay. Thank you for your consideration.
Okay.
Thank you, Senators.
All right, John. John, now it's Nanheim, Nikki Terzieff.
Hi, good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Monis Anderson, Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. We are over the moon to be able to have this conversation in front of this committee today, and I'll just lay out up front, we're supportive of the Dash 2s, as Mr. Powell had indicated. We're certainly supportive of the Dash 3s. This bill has had a long and interesting history before it's made its way over to you. And at each step along the way, we have seen amazing support from committee members in the House Healthcare, from members on the floor of the House, folks who recognize that optometric physicians in Oregon have been kind of put into a corner by a lot of these plans. we're talking about patient bases of 50, 60, 70% of traffic that comes through any individual optometric physician's office. And so what's important to us is that we have these options, that our doctors have the options for patient choice, for patient convenience, to help bend the cost curve for patients. And a lot of that is done at the local level. So again, another reason we're very excited about the Dash 3 is that it puts in and reinstalls a piece of the bill that was taken out over on the other side, over in the House chamber, and we have assurance that we will have concurrence from the chair over there should we be able to move this with the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s, which is very exciting. Our optometric physicians have been in here to talk about the merits of the base bill, not just from the doctor's perspective, but again, from the patient's perspective. What's important here is that our ability and their ability to serve constituents in every district across the state of Oregon and get them what they need medically as well as when it comes to materials and goods. So being able to not pay out of pocket, if you will, in order to provide services for those who are parts of these major networks. There are about 4, 5, maybe 6 large national companies that have these major networks that our folks need to participate in order to provide what Representative Hoyle was talking about, the jobs and the economy at the local level. And so to strike the balance between being able to serve those patients and maintain their jobs and their employment opportunities for Oregonians is very important to us. So please do support this bill with the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology, which is the professional association of medical eye doctors. And really, I'm just here to give you all the serendipitous experience of ophthalmologists testifying with optometrists in support of a bill. It doesn't have quite the same impact on our members, but many of our members do work closely with optometrists, and we are happy to support the bill, as well as the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much. Paul Cosgrove and Lisa Tressel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing the National Association of Vision Care Plans. The National Association includes standalone vision care plans that only provide that benefit, as well as a number of major health insurers who, as part of their benefits, include a vision care benefit. And we're opposed to the bill, in particular opposed to the A3 amendment, and I'd be glad to describe our concerns. With respect to the bill before it's amended, as it sits before you now in its A and gross version, we have three concerns, and I can briefly describe each of those three. One, it would prevent us from negotiating, and I use that term advisedly, negotiating with optometrists for discounts for consumers who choose to purchase for example, second pair of glasses, one that isn't covered by the insurance, but for which their benefit package allows a discount. Number two, it has complications and problems for us in maintaining our network, and I'll give you some specifics of that. And number three, it just has an unworkable provision with respect to contract changes that make it almost impossible for us to assume that we're going to have network adequacy at any given time for our members. First of all, on the discounts, you've already heard on the Dash A2s, which is Mr. Powell's client's amendments, which excludes from the bill, and we don't oppose the Dash A2s, excludes from the bill those people who provide discount cards without any insurance benefit. So it seems to us a little illogical for those who provide insurance could not also have a discount option as part of that package if we negotiate it with our optometrists. What those discounts typically mean is your benefit package may cover the initial pair of lenses and some amount of frames. If the consumer chooses to purchase a pair of sunglasses or a second pair of glasses, they may not be covered as an insurance benefit, but these discounts that some of our plans negotiate with optometrists allow those consumers to get a discount. That discount is variable based on the negotiations with the optometrist. The optometrist preserves the right to set the retail price of the lens, so the net that's coming back to the optometrist is solely within the optometrist's purview, but it does provide a consumer benefit. With respect to network, the bill in Section 2 sub 2B, the portion I just talked about in terms of discounts is in Section 2 sub 2A. So in Section 2, Sub 2B, the language in that section, we believe, does not allow us to do a number of things that are common within the industry and necessary for us to operate. Recall that I mentioned some of our members are standalone vision care plans, not providing any other kind of health insurance coverage. Others of them are units of other health insurers. If a health insurer decides to, for example, stop providing a vision care benefit itself but to contract with an independent company, and some of them have done that and like to have that option to be able to do that, to have that specialized benefit managed by a specialized company, they need the ability to cancel the contracts with their optometrists. They're all under contract. They all have cancellation provisions like most contracts do, and then contract with the separate entity. Those optometrists have the ability, if they wish, to also contract as to be a provider with that entity. We believe the language in 2B doesn't permit that as written. We also don't believe that the language in 2B allows us to credential if we are a standalone vision care plan working with a different health insurer, credential those vision care plan those vision care providers under the vision care plan separately from what the health plan might or might not do. So that's our second concern. The third one is represented in some language in 2C. 2C talks about changes in contract terms and requiring written acknowledgments. In most cases, we don't have any problem with that. In fact, that's what the practice is. If we change contract terms, we require a new contract to be signed. That's general contract law. But some of our contracts, in fact, for pricing, refer to some other kind of price schedule, like, say, Medicare, and we will pay blank percent of Medicare for these materials and these services. If Medicare changes their fees, the contract automatically changes because we've negotiated with our providers a blank percentage of some third party's fee schedule. We need to have an exemption in the prohibition in 2C to not require a separate written acknowledgement every time a third party changes their fee schedule, if that's the fee schedule we've incorporated by reference into our contract, knowing that it might change in the future, but at some unknown time. It's not a change we're instigating. It's one that the contract is following because the parties have agreed to use that third party reference schedule. We have amendments that are being drafted with respect to those three provisions. They're not available ready yet today, but we're working with Lori Freeman to see if we can get them ready very promptly. We've submitted them through committee counsel, and the first draft came back with some problems that we need to resolve. With respect to the lab issue, if you look at you actually can't see it in the Engrosted, you have to look at the original bill. The original bill states that we cannot do anything that directly or indirectly, and those words are important, affects the optometrist's choice of lab. We need to have the ability to preserve our right to negotiate with labs. Some of our companies actually own their own labs, as Representative Widener mentioned. Not very many, but one does. But with respect to the others, we need to be able to negotiate prices with labs. We're then willing to pay those labs that price to any other lab, but we don't think, just like if you go to an out-of-network provider on your health insurance, you may end up paying more. If you go to an out-of-network lab in this context, you might end up paying more. And if you adopt the -A3 as written, restoring to the original bill, that's going to prevent us from being able to do that. Those things will raise costs. Some of these things that we're talking about, I think, are difficult for consumers. Some of them are difficult for people who are paying the bill, whether that be the consumer or, in some cases, employers. I'd point out that the committee has received, just as of today, this afternoon, a letter from UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555, opposing the bill for all the reasons I've just stated, because they run their own health care benefits, including a vision care plan, and they know how this would adversely affect their members in getting vision care benefits and their costs in providing those. So I'd encourage you to see that. I know it's come out very quickly. You undoubtedly have not been without other things to do in the last couple of hours, so may not have been able to see it yet. With that, I'd be glad to close and answer any questions.
Let's have Lisa, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Health Plan of Oregon, here also in opposition to A. Engrost House Bill 3530, primarily for the reasons that Mr. Cosgrove stated, but definitely because of the issue with it. We believe it will increase the members' cost from what they're paying after the insurance, the eye plan, the vision plan pays their share. We think that the inability to direct where they go to get the lenses and such will increase the out-of-pocket that the member pays. And there's that's the main concern with all of the legislation. It's not, it's just another piece. Now, granted, vision plans typically are not very expensive riders to a medical health plan, but the coinsurance or the amount the consumer pays when they pick up the glasses could increase with this bill because of the ability for anyone to, we can't require them to go to where the prices have been negotiated down.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Senator Steiner.
I have a question for Mr. Cosgrove, and I actually, with your permission, Madam Chair, I have a question for Ms. Terzieff that came up as a result of Mr. Cosgrove's state testimony. Mr. Cosgrove, with regard to the lab point that you made, you made the analogy to in and out of network providers for health plans, right? And you said, and forgive me if I'm misquoting you or misheard you, that your concern is that if consumers had to choose between essentially the equivalent of in and out of network labs, it would be too confusing for them. Consumers do that all. Okay. So I guess the question I have for you is, why couldn't you treat labs, the ones you contract with and the ones you don't contract with, exactly the same way that health plans treat in and out of network providers and let consumers make an informed choice just as they do currently with in and out of network healthcare providers?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I didn't mean to imply that it was a confusion issue. I believe it's a cost issue. As drafted, the Dash 3s and the original base bill wouldn't allow us to do that. What it doesn't allow us to do is say, negotiate a price with a lab. We'll pay this much for this particular kind of lens with this particular kind of treatment, bifocal, trifocal, all the permutations. And then say, you can go to any lab you want, but this is all we're going to pay. The bill itself says we cannot directly or indirectly influence the choice of lab. And we believe, we believe it's quite clear, that that would be an indirect influence if we said we're only going to pay this much. The second issue is, with respect to the one example you were given by Representative Hoyle of a lab in her district owned by an optometrist, one of our members, I think this is not uncommon, has a bit of concern about paying for services at different kinds of different kinds of labs and other kinds of services owned by the provider. The connection between the provider, and at least they're very concerned about making sure that they have control over the price so that they're not paying more than the market price when there's that close connection. So there are two sets of things that would be, I think, legitimate concerns from the insurer's perspective and the consumer's perspective that would not be permitted if the A3 were adopted.
So if I may, Madam Chair, so were the language to be clearer that insurance visions plans, however you want to construct it, could not limit a consumer's choice in terms of saying you can't go here or we won't pay anything, as opposed, but instead said these are in-network ones and those are out-of-network ones. If you go to in-network ones, here's what we'll pay, and if we go to out-of-network ones, here's what we're going to pay, and let the consumer make that choice. Would that be acceptable to you?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, yes. Now, the amendments we are being drafted now don't address this. We weren't aware that the A3 was coming back. But, yes, that kind of a provision could be added to the amendments we're drafting.
Okay.
And it provide exactly that thing.
All right. Thank you. And, Ms. Terzieff, I guess first I'll start with this, and you may not be able to answer this on the fly, but were the language to be constructed in the way that I just proposed to Mr. Cosgrove, how would the optometric physicians feel about that as an option?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I probably would not be able to answer that on the fly. I think for us, the bottom line is that our patients have a choice and that our practitioners have the ability to do what they do best, which is help guide their patients to what they need.
And so I would appreciate it personally, unless Madam Chair intends to move this today, if if it doesn't happen that we move this today, I would appreciate if you would circle with your folks and let me know about whether that would be a reasonable, let the chair and as well know about whether that would be a reasonable middle ground from your group's perspective. But the second question I have for you is with regard to this issue of discounts on a second pair of glasses, right? I belong to a gym, right? And my gym has an affiliate program. So if I go to one of the businesses that's an affiliate of my gym, I get a discount, whether that's a percent discount or a certain amount off of a certain price purchase or whatever. And it's part of my contract with the gym, right? And the affiliates can choose whether they affiliate with, they become part of this affiliate program or not, right? So if optometrists or labs contract with an insurance provider to provide a vision benefit, and the contract says, here's how much we're going to pay for the primary pair of glasses, and then part of the contract is we're happy to, you know, have the person continue to get glasses from you, but if they're going to want to get a second pair, part of their overall benefit structure to help enable them to get a second pair of glasses, which can be good for safety purposes or to have a backup pair for people with poor vision or whatever, optometrists or labs could choose to opt in or out on that regard too. I guess I'm struggling with why that's a big sticking point for your team. I'm overall generally supportive of this, but I'm trying to play devil's advocate on both sides here.
Sure. Well, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I think what you'll find is something of a prisoner's choice. You have a dynamic and large network, which is, again, makes up the majority of the traffic of your business. And so if your gym strikes a deal with the juice bar down the street and your carrot apple juice is 10% off, but this time you want blueberry and blueberry is 20% off, and at this point, right, the juice bar, I apologize for the silly analogy, but
it
at
works.
This point, you know, the juice bar is looking at, do I lose every gym member who walks through my door to refresh themselves?
Mm-hmm.
And what does that spell for my traffic? Because I'm located right here by the gym, and people know me locally in the community, but maybe that's not enough to really kind of keep me afloat. You need that. You rely on that client base to help drive, again, the Oregon-based jobs and the local economy.
If I may, Madam Chair. Thank you. And first of all, congratulations on picking up on my analogy and running with it in a very, very impressive way. Your point's well taken. I guess thinking about as someone who's worn expensive glasses for almost my entire life, I'm not sure I'd buy a second pair of glasses at all. I might make do with clip-on sunglasses or those horrible, ugly fitovers if I had to pay full freight for a pair of prescription sunglasses. And I guess I see your point, but I'm not sure that this isn't the case of half a loaf being better than none. So I'd like you to think about that one a little bit, too. I get where you're coming from, and I don't want people to be stuck in that, you know, optometrist. You know what a strong supporter of optometrists I am. And as I said, I'm playing devil's advocate on both sides. But I would like your thoughts about whether sticking to your guns on that one is cutting off your nose to spite your face, to use an old-fashioned analogy. I don't know the answer, Ms. Terzieff, and I'd appreciate feedback. I don't know what the profit margins are on these things, and I'm not asking you to divulge trade secrets, but I'd like some thoughts on that. And Mr. Cosgrove, I'd like some thoughts on some ways to make consumers have more choice without throwing the insurance companies completely under the bus. So I'd appreciate follow-up from both of you.
Madam Chair, if I may, just one final comment with respect to what Senator Hayward just said. Recall that if you adopt the Dash 2s, you're allowing discount cards, but just for the non-insurance companies. And if you don't adopt our amendments, you would be prohibiting it for the insurance companies, which seems a little odd. Secondly, I mentioned this, but I'd like to reemphasize it. The price for materials, and we're only talking about discounts in materials. The bill is drafted to prevent discounts in services and materials. We're fine with not having discounts on services, the optometrist service. We're only talking about materials. But recall that I mentioned that The price for the materials, the second pair of glasses, is set by the optometrist. So the optometrist controls the net back. It's not like there is a price set by somebody else and we're getting a discount out of off that.
Oh, I understand.
It's the optometrist's price, so they can determine how much net profit they get from that transaction.
Well,
and under those circumstances, yeah. Well, it's all based on market and pressures and all of those other things. But it's not as if we're taking money that they have no choice about in terms of some flexibility of how to handle it.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I'm good with it, with the bill.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to know how comfortable the committee is. I'm comfortable with the A2s and A3s, but if you would rather wait for the amendments from Mr. Cosgrove and to take a look at some answers back from Nikki, I sort of need input from you two. Okay, we will wait and we will carry it over.
I really support this bill. Please understand that. I mean, really, really support it. I really do. I just want to make sure that we dot I's and cross T's.
Okay.
Thank you.
We will carry this over until June 1st. Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3530. And colleagues, let me get back to my let's get this one out of the way. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2758, Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2758A prohibits carriers and third-party administrators from disclosing to anyone other than the enrollee receiving services personal information about an enrollee upon the request of the dependent enrollee. It specifies the procedure for enrollees making confidential communication requests. It requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to submit a report on the effectiveness of the process. It changes the definition of personal health information to protected health information. It protects confidential communication and appeal of adverse benefit determination. There's a dash A11 amendment and a dash A12 amendment, and there's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, we're in work session.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Would you like a bipartisan bill?
I want a bipartisan bill.
Excellent. Then I move the A11s.
Okay. So
walked right into that.
Senator Canope moves to adopt the dash A11s. And Zena, can you review what the A11s do again?
Dash A11 amendments defines enrollees someone 18 years of age or older.
And the reason why you would want this amendment?
Because I think anything under 18 really disenfranchises parents and parental rights. And even though somebody could, get a procedure, I think it's imperative that parents are involved in the discussion of those. And I think we heard testimony from Representative Hack about how those explanation of benefits have been beneficial in parental child communication. And I think you're going to get a bipartisan bill if we start at 18, because I think there's a legitimate part of the bill because of the ACA that adult children probably don't want their parents knowing about their health care. I mean, I can see that in our own family where, we'll have a married son on our health care, and I particularly don't want to know about that. And so I think it's appropriate for those cases that those explanation of benefits be sent somewhere else. But for a 9-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old or according to LC, there's no minimum age requirement in the bill. So an enrollee can make a confidential communications request, and a hypothetical 9-year-old could make a request to have information sent to a location other than their parents' address. And I just don't think that's right. And so, therefore, the A11s, I think, are appropriate.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
While I appreciate Senator Knope's concerns, I would point out a couple of things. The decision about whether children can seek health care for certain things, or people under the age of 18 can seek health care for certain conditions independent of their parents, has been made long ago in the state of Oregon. And we know that for both mental health and substance abuse issues and for reproductive health issues, and I would really focus on the mental health issues in this case, Madam Chair, we have already made a decision as a state that people under the age of, at any age, can seek care for those conditions independently. I would further point out that at the age of 15 in Oregon, one can seek medical care for anything independently, and that has been upheld by the courts in this state and has been upheld by this legislature for a very long time. I appreciate Senator Knope's concern, and I do think that conversations between parents of children are generally optimal. However, I would point out, imagine for a moment that there was a young person in high school who had significant depression and anxiety issues, but whose parents firmly believed that any mental health issue was a matter of a character flaw rather than a medical condition. And those parents would refuse categorically to pay for any care related to mental health issues. But that child, for example, perhaps had a friend whose parents were willing to help subsidize the care. It would be fairly easy to get the bill sent to that person and have that other person be a responsible party. But if the EOBs went to the child's parents, that could cause irreparable harm to the child and prohibit that child from getting the care that they needed for important mental health issues. I firmly believe, Madam Chair, that this bill is currently structured exactly as it should be. And while I respect Senator Knope's perspective, this is not only solely about reproductive health. This is about all kinds of health care that the state has already determined people under the age of 18 can legitimately get without parental engagement, and it's important to protect their privacy.
I did ask Elsie, and I got information back that the A11s would violate HIPAA to the extent that they allow disclosure to someone other than a parent, or if disclosed to a parent, the disclosure would endanger the minor or the minor has been subjected to domestic violence, abuse, or neglect by the parent. So the dash A11s, at least from our legislative council, would violate HIPAA. Any further discussions? Clerk will call the roll on the dash A11.
Senator
Cope? Aye.
Senator Shields?
Nope.
No.
Vice Chair Crew?
Excused.
Chairwoman Sanders?
No. Amendment fails.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2758A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves House Bill 2758 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, before
yes.
we do that, there was dash 12 that I think there might be. I don't know if there's somebody who wanted to testify on those. No? All right.
Okay. No one here to talk about the A12s. Okay. We have any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll on the base bill. I mean on the, on 2758.
Okay.
Aye.
No.
Excuse. Aye. Motion carries. And, I forgot.
Senator Burdick, I think, is the.
Oh, yes. Senator Burdick will carry the bill, and I will close the works session on House Bill 2758. And open a work session on House Bill 3343.
Do you want to say anything? Or can I just go?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3343A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves House Bill 3343 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. I think that there was an amendment proposed that came from the carriers that we're not going to consider, but I think we wanted to put something on the record about that.
The A3s, Madam Chair?
The A3s.
I will say one thing, yes, about this. I do, thank you for the reminder.
Yes.
There's been some question about whether this would change how we think about prescribing drugs other than contraceptives. And I want to make it clear that as a physician, I consider contraceptives to be an entirely different class of drugs than pretty much anything else in the market for two reasons. The first is that unlike most drugs that physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs prescribe, these are preventive drugs rather than treatment drugs. They are designed to prevent pregnancy rather than treat high blood pressure or any other medical condition. And we know that, generally speaking, once a woman has been stabilized on a certain form of oral contraception, that she stays stable on that form usually for many years and is unlikely to change over. And that is not true for drugs that treat hypertension. It's not true for drugs that treat diabetes. It's not true for pretty much any other treatment class of drugs. And so as a physician, I would almost never be inclined, I really can't think, frankly, of a circumstance. I may write a prescription that would be valid for a year, but I would never want someone getting more than 90 days at a time, because that's usually how often I want them checking back with me. So I want to be crystal clear that I'm supporting this because contraceptives are in their own class of medication and are very different from any other class. And that's why I think this is a good bill, and it's really important to make sure that women don't have to worry about running to the pharmacy every month or even every 3 months, especially when younger women have busy lives and often have work hours that keep them away from pharmacies at reasonable hours. So I think this is a really important bill, but I don't consider it precedent setting in any way, Madam Chair.
Other discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator
Hill? Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
It's the
12-month. Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And would someone like to carry the bill?
I would.
Yes. Senator Steiner Hayward will carry the bill.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 3343 and open a work session on House Bill 2023.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2023A directs hospitals to adopt and enforce discharge policies for individuals that have been treated for a behavioral health crisis. It specifies criteria to be included in the policy. There's a dash A5 amendment, which removes the maximum age requirements. It requires a process to coordinate care to the extent practicable and requires documenting when scheduling follow-up appointments within seven days of discharge. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2023.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A5 amendments into House Bill 2023A. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2023A as amended by the dash A5 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2023A as adopted with the A5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Hill?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Aye. Motion carries. Is there someone that would like to carry this bill? Okay, I'll carry it. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2023 and open a work session on House Bill 2028.
House Bill 2028A directs the State Board of Pharmacy to adopt rules that permit pharmacists to engage in the practice of clinical pharmacy. It permits health insurers to provide payment or reimbursement for services provided by the pharmacists through the practice of clinical pharmacy or pursuant to the statewide drug therapy management protocol. It limits participation from practitioner to physician. It adds the Oregon Health Authority and coordinated care organizations to reimburse pharmacists or pharmacies under specified situations. It states that for this statute, a pharmacist is classified as a primary care provider. There's no amendment, and there's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
I just want to recess just for a minute. Okay, we will reconvene, and we are in work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2028A be passed recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2028A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Kilk?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry the pharmacy bill? Okay. Senator Cruz will carry it. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2028A. And open a... this one. Work session on House Bill 2876A.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2876A prohibits healthcare facilities from allowing a person without specified qualifications and education to practice surgical technology. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2876A to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2876A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. And in the process of elimination, Senator Knope, will you carry this bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Knope will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2876 and open a work session on House Bill 2948. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2848A specifies additional conditions under which protected health information may be disclosed by a healthcare provider that does not subject the provider to civil liability. It clarifies additional conditions under which a healthcare provider may disclose protected health information for an individual being treated for mental illness without obtaining an authorization from the individual or a personal representative. There's dash A4 amendment, which adds that healthcare providers who make disclosures in specified circumstances are not subject to civil liability. There's a dash A5 amendment, which names the legislation the Susanna Gebe Act. There's a fiscal statement issued and no revenue impact.
Okay. I think we wanted to have... is Lori Freeman here?
Because of that one.
Can you just go over the A4s and the A5s amendments for us, please?
Well, as soon as I find them. Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from the Office of Legislative Counsel. Let's see. The A4 amendments restore some language that was in the original bill that just says a healthcare provider is not subject to any civil liability for making a disclosure in accordance with this section. And while our office always likes to give a caveat that it's
it's not for us to say with but it's for the courts to decide whether or not someone can the legislature can grant civil immunity. I think it's pretty safe for this section, at least, because it's completely consistent with HIPAA, all of the disclosures that are allowed.
Any questions? Okay. And then the A5s?
The A5 simply names it the Susanna Blake Gabe Act, who is the daughter who died of one of the proponents for the bill.
Okay. Thanks so much. Ms. Freeman, all right.
I'm trying to move the -A4 amendment and do House Bill 2948A.
Senator Cruz moves the -A4 amendments into House Bill 2948. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? It's adopted.
I'm trying to move the -A5 amendment into House Bill 2948A.
Senator Cruz moves the -A5 amendments into House Bill 2948A. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2948A as amended by the -A4 and -A5 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2948A with the A4 and A5 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Winters is on the bill, so we will ask Senator Winters to carry that bill, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2948A. And we did this one?
Which one did we carry over?
This one.
2028, we're doing 2028. Yeah, we did 2028. Yeah. 2630 and 3534 carried.
And 35. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Can we recess briefly so
I
can talk to some folks about the
palm
tree bill?
Yeah, we're going into informational.
Okay, that's fine. Thanks.
So we did this one? Yes. And we did this one. Okay. All right. We are now going to have an informational hearing.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Before you go there, I would request the rules be suspended I've been in a transportation work group. It's still meeting. I would like to have the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing me to vote on the bills I missed.
Senator Cruz moves. Can you move for yourself? Moves to have the rules suspended so that he can vote on the bills that he missed, which I do not know.
I know one of them. Madam Chair, point of order, can we suspend the rules with only four members in the committee?
All four would have to agree.
And I think I would be interested in knowing what one of Senator Cruz's votes might be on one of these bills before I agree to it.
Suspend the rules and you'll find out.
It's only this one. That's the only one he's missed. He was here for all the others.
As a matter of fairness, the transportation work group just started today. Okay. It's kind of an important thing. I had texted the chair saying, let me know when you need me, and I didn't get a text. So it was inadvertent that I was missing, but I was on legislative business. So,
I don't think I feel comfortable suspending the rules on this one. Wait, hold on a second. Can we sit at ease for a moment?
Okay, we're going to be at ease. And so,
I'm willing to follow your lead.
If you're willing to suspend the rules, he's willing to suspend the rules too.
I'm not willing to suspend the rules at this point in time. All right. Okay. All right. We're going to open let's go back at ease again. All right, let us resume an informational hearing on the Alzheimer's State Plan.
Chairwoman Monis Anderson and the members of the Senate Health Care Committee, for the record, my name is Jason Hess. I'm the CEO of Elite Care, and I wanted to thank you for your support for the state plan and your commitment to addressing Alzheimer's disease in Oregon. I served as the co-chair of the task force that created the state plan for Alzheimer's disease in Oregon, which we refer to as SPADO. The process to create the state plan was very collaborative. My co-chair was Jennifer Mead from DHS APD. And the task force included other long-term care providers, staff of the state, county agencies, nonprofits, including the Alzheimer's Association and AARP of Oregon, researchers and educators from Portland Community College and OHSU, doctors, nurses, and social workers, elder law experts, and people who have experienced the impact of Alzheimer's in their own family and have been a caregiver for a loved one. We are also thankful for the involvement of Senator Monis Anderson and Senator Dembro on the task force. These stakeholders came together over nearly 3 years ago to craft a plan to address Alzheimer's crisis. The first meeting of the SPADO task force was held in November of 2010. That initial group then formed five work groups to focus on specific areas. The first area was public education and awareness. The second was legal and financial. The third was continuum of care. The fourth was medical research. The fifth was public safety. In addition to the expertise of the group, the task force also held six town hall meetings around Oregon and a telephone town hall meeting last year to get the public input on what should be in the state plan. Hundreds of Oregonians from Brookings to Pendleton, from Portland to Bend, took part in these events and provided much useful information. Furthermore, we developed an online survey that hundreds of people filled out that gave us some further insight into the needs of people impacted by Alzheimer's in Oregon. Once the task force was heard, the public input recommendations were written and then vetted through dozens of other stakeholders in Oregon to get their feedback into the plan. The state plan is a culmination of all that work, five goals and 10 recommendations that represent action that can be taken right away and has been taken, which you guys will hear today, by state government, nonprofits, and the private sector, which work together and will continue to help Oregonians impacted by Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. As a member of the private sector, I appreciate being involved in crafting the public policy and the impact it's had on Elite Care residents and our business practices. While this may not address every need of every person impacted by Alzheimer's, the plan represents a starting point from which we can move forward to ensure that services are provided in an effective and efficient manner and move us towards a world without Alzheimer's. These stakeholders continue to work together to make sure this plan is implemented and does not sit on the shelf gathering dust. Alzheimer's can't wait, so we will see this through.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larissa Kaufman. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter. I also want to thank Chair Monis Anderson for all of her work and leadership on addressing Alzheimer's in the state of Oregon, and also thank Senator Knope for his leadership and for spearheading the passage of the Silver Alert Bill last year, which requires law enforcement agencies in the state of Oregon to have policies and procedures in place for vulnerable adults who go missing. I'm going to start off with some statistics. 60,000 Oregonians over the age of 65 are living with Alzheimer's. That's 10% of our senior population here. One in eight Oregonians over the age of 45 has reported experiencing some form of cognitive decline. Of that one in eight, 68% have reported that they have not shared this or sought help from a medical provider. Last year in Oregon, about 175,000 unpaid Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers provided nearly 200 million hours of unpaid care, valued at more than $2.4 billion. Since the state plan was released in July of 2012, we've made some significant strides. I'm going to focus on goal one, which is public awareness and education. In 2013, Oregon received a three-year federal grant from the Administration for Community Living, ACL, for nearly $750,000. The state contributed matching funds for nearly $300,000. Thanks to the ACL funding, we accomplished one of the two recommendations under our public awareness goal. That was, we launched a specific section of the Resource Connection website focused on Alzheimer's. And between January 2015 and March 2015, there have been over 1,300 visits to that page alone. Additionally, due to the ACL grant, dementia-specific training was provided to the ADRC staff to help increase expertise and understanding. By the end of this three-year grant, which is in the fall of 2016, we will have trained nearly 100% of ADRC staff members on dementia, on resources, and how to provide that information to Oregonians. In addition to the ACL grant funding, in 2013 and 2014, because of the change in the senior medical deduction, legislators allocated $3.3 million in funding for caregiver and first responder training throughout the state. To date, nearly 4,000 classes have been completed through Oregon Care Partners. Today, we ask for your support in the continued investment of $3.3 million for training, and also your continued support in funding for senior services and people with disabilities so that we can ensure that the state plan continues to move forward. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Maria Kane. As an educator with 37 years experience in the field, I provide training to paid and unpaid caregivers as well as to first responders. And today I'd like to share a real-life situation where law enforcement training in Alzheimer's helps significantly. Several evenings a week, around 4 p.m., a man with Alzheimer's disease aggressively forced his wife out of their home. She would argue with him, explaining again and over again that she was his wife, and tearfully pleading with him to please remember. The man was not aware that the guns in his house had been removed, snuck out, and he would frequently threaten his wife and the officers who came to help that he would indeed shoot. By proceeding calmly and respectfully, the officers were able to calm the situation and worked effectively with the family and himself to come up with solutions. The man had confided to the officers, "This lady thinks she's my wife, but my wife is going to be very angry when she comes home and finds this old lady sitting in her chair." In the short term, we trained the wife to step out and come back a few minutes later, announcing, "Honey, I'm home," to help him frame that this was his wife returning home from work. In the long term, we were able to find him a more supportive living environment where his wife could enjoy safe visits with him. And actually, we got him a job there as a security officer, and his presence probably did provide a sense of safety and well-being for the other people who lived there because he had a very strong and protective demeanor. Officers credit the approaching Alzheimer's classes along with crisis intervention training for helping them enhance their skills needed in responding to difficult situations with persons with compromised ability to reason and to make sound judgments. The whole subject of Alzheimer's disease took a new turn for me personally when my father, Bill Whitney, was diagnosed in 2012. For several years prior to his diagnosis, he had been experiencing increased confusion and memory loss. And in 2006, his doctor noted MCI, meaning mild cognitive impairment. She noted that in his records, but she had not given voice to her concerns. In the fall of 2011, We began seeking a diagnosis and guidance after he caught his kitchen on fire and drove his car through a double-story garage. In the beginning of 2012, my dad reluctantly engaged with the programs available through the Alzheimer's Association, and he quickly discovered that the emphasis was not on who he was as an Alzheimer's patient, but on who he was as an artist and as a human being. His life opened up again to joy, creating, and relating. My dad, Bill Whitney, spoke at the press conference unveiling Spado and here at the Capitol, both in 2012. He was very grateful for all the services he and my mom had received, and he wanted everyone in Oregon who has dementia and their family members to have access to the services they need. He stated, "Instead of living in fear, I live with hope. My desire is for all Oregonians living with dementia to have the same hope." Bill Whitney passed away on March 2, 2014. My desire is to carry on his legacy of hope. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today, and we appreciate your ongoing support for the state plan.
Thank you so much, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I'm so glad. I think it's so important for us to remember that we have a tsunami effect of Alzheimer's happening in this state, and we need to care for them and love them. And I'm just, we didn't have any specific bills except your request for funding, I mean, for senior services and those with disabilities. So are there any questions for this panel? We'll probably have you come back in a year, give us an update, or maybe 2 years. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Anyone else that's going to come up? Okay. And then we will be addressing two more bills. We're going to be working two more bills that I thought. No, we're going to work one more bill and allow him to. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is Ashley Carson Cottingham, and I'm our Deputy Director at the Aging and People with Disabilities Program at the Department of Human Services. Today, I'm here to share a little bit about Goal 4 of the state plan. And Goal 4 is improving access to quality care. And specifically, I'm going to focus on 4A. And that goal says that we want to develop appropriate care settings and services for persons with dementia who require a higher level of expertise and staff in helping to manage their significant behavioral needs. So I'm happy to report out about our achievements in this arena. DHS Aging and People with Disabilities has been very active in developing settings and services for people with dementia who exhibit significant behaviors. This work helps to prevent move-outs that are related to these behaviors, and further settings need to be developed that can appropriately support this population. So I want to share a couple of examples across the state where these settings have been developed. In Bandon, a residential care facility has expanded their services to provide complex behavioral support. They have 10 beds dedicated to supporting this population, and all of the beds are full. And all of those residents have come out of nursing facilities and into this more appropriate care setting type, where there's additional staffing to meet the needs of those particular residents. The second example is McKinsey Living Residential Care Facility in Lane County. And this facility supports people with dementia who also have other mental health needs. The features of this setting include the fact that each resident has their very own private room. There's a psychiatrist that's on site for 20 hours a month. There are 6 staff on duty during the day and the evening, and then there are 2 at night. And all of the staff that they hire for this setting type have relevant and significant experience previous to their position at McKinsey Living in a memory care type of setting. There's also a full-time behavioral support consultant on staff, and there's 1.5 full-time equivalent staff for activities for this population. And lastly, they do have sensors on doors and cameras in their facility. So the second achievement is that DHS Aging and People with Disabilities has developed special needs contracts with APD Medicaid providers of residential care facilities and adult foster homes that ensure there's a certain number of beds and person-centered support services for people with dementia who have significant behavioral needs. And lastly, the Department of Human Services provides behavior support services as part of the Medicaid-funded Community First Choice, or K, state plan option to work with providers within the consumer's living environment to explore all of the potential triggers and develop a way to change the environment or the approach between the caregiver and the consumer. This service can be provided in their home or in other setting types. And the way that the consumer can access this service is through their long-term services and supports case manager through our Medicaid programs. It's also a required service for some of the settings that have the special needs contracts in place that I mentioned just before. When the program was developed, we also developed a survey so that once the behavioral support specialist has worked with the provider in whatever setting the consumer resides, they would leave the survey with the provider so that we could have a way to know if the services are helping or working. And so we have just a few statistics here around information we've gathered from that survey. 65% of the consumers maintained their placement due to the behavioral support services. 89% of the survey respondents, usually in a community-based care setting type, responded in the affirmative that they would use the services again if the need arose. And 57% of the consumers negative or difficult behaviors decrease due to the use of a behavioral support services specialist. So our next steps, we'll be continuing all of this work, and we want to have ongoing evaluation of the effectiveness of these three areas, the care settings and the services. The next meeting of the work group around this goal for the state plan is scheduled in mid-June, and they'll continue to look at the progress that's being made in this area. And then the department will continue to do ongoing reviews, especially when a move out is triggered for whatever reason, because we want to ensure that that's really a last resort and we can work with the resident to make sure they might not have to move. We could prevent the move out. And then we monitor the special needs contracts to ensure that all the right staffing levels are in place, that the enhanced care planning is going on, and that one of the significant components of the contract is that there's enhanced activities happening in these specific setting types that really help consumers with these needs. And we want to work really closely with both the consumers and the facilities to make sure that their needs are met. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I am the state legal services developer, a position established under the Older Americans Act. It's a counterpart position in that federal Older Americans Act to the state long-term care ombudsman. And the reason I mention that in the context is my position is focused on rights and advocacy of seniors, in particular older adults. But in the way that functions here in Oregon is really looking at rights and enhancing rights of all vulnerable adults or potentially vulnerable adults. As it relates to SPADO, I was fortunate to work on the legal work group that created and established recommendation 3 in the SPADO plan and wanted to provide an update. I've been fortunate to work on the SPADO implementation team in the last couple years with an emphasis on recommendation 3A, which is focused on guardianship training and primarily where that looks at is the lay guardians, those family members that are serving as a guardian or conservator for their loved one that has dementia. previously, and the reason for this recommendation is that somebody might be appointed as guardian. So they, you know, go through the $5,000 to $7,000 process through the courts. They get appointed as guardian, therefore the decision maker. So if for guardian purposes, social health decisions, if a conservator, financial decisions for their loved one with dementia, and then they're just kind of patted on the back and told, good luck, go make decisions. And they're supposed to be making decisions, not necessarily for that individual that they're serving as guardian or conservator, but they should be making decisions in an ideal world as that person would make decisions for themselves. So hence the need for training, and as the recommendation emphasizes in the SPADO plan, training that includes an emphasis on dementia training when appropriate for all guardians in Oregon. That recommendation was really a culmination of efforts of a number of stakeholders in Oregon recognizing this need for training for decades. And it found its way into the SPADO plan, and seems to be that the SPADO plan really was a kickstarter to get some movement on this, again, decades-old need. So this body in 2013 passed House Bill 3129, I think I have that right, that required certification of professional guardians and conservators. Within that certification requirement that's now effective as of January 2014, there is training that's a part of that naturally to be certified, and a part of that training is at that national level dementia-focused training. For the lay guardians, the family guardians, the non-professional guardians, some of the individuals that had been a part of the SPADO work group and that legal work group and this recommendation kind of joined efforts with a nonprofit in the Multnomah County area, Special Advocates for Vulnerable Oregonians, that have been able to establish under their leadership and that nonprofit's leadership and guidance, one of their two primary missions is they have established a guardian training. As of August of last year, Multnomah County and their courts, when they appoint a guardian or conservator, they mandate that the training be completed within 60 to 90 days. Clackamas County is now, that mandate is now expanded into Clackamas County here in just the last couple of months. And again, the goal, the hope is that it will expand statewide into all 36 counties. But there's a great foundation that has now been established. So that's the update on the recommendation. Real quick, I'd like to also just speak to the reason for having this guardianship focus in the state plan for Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and the need for continued improvement on our infrastructures related to guardianships and conservatorships. I've spoken to at least a couple of you on this committee, maybe here or in other committees, on a group of stakeholders that have come together here in Oregon. To some degree, there's an element of it being an extension of the SPADO group and work and guardianship. But there's this new work group, a real interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary effort referred to as WINGS, Working Interdisciplinary Network of Guardianship Stakeholders. We have about 35 individuals here in Oregon, including your colleague, Senator Michael Dembro, that is a member of that group, and working on a number of fronts to improve infrastructure, training, education, building tools, building guidance. In my written testimony, I have a link to a website that provides some of the materials that we've been able to produce in the year and a half that the WINGS group has been together, but also supporting legislative efforts that will improve, whether that's just assisting, providing feedback, input that'll improve our infrastructures. There's some legislation was passed last year, like the statewide public guardian program. A number of you have been involved in some of the efforts legislatively. I'll say, for example, House Bill 4114. I know Senator Montes Anderson, you were a co-sponsor with Representative Gallegos on that established or gives courts clear authority to appoint monitors to monitor guardianships and conservatorships that they have concerns over. And then this session, I know you had mentioned that maybe there isn't legislation focused on dementia, and maybe not necessarily, but Senator Montes Anderson Cruz is co-sponsors with Senator Dembro on Senate Bill 471.
Right.
Yeah. Very much related to this work and dementia work. So, that's a bill that would create a right to legal counsel for people that are proposed protected persons, so that person that's about to have or may have a guardian or conservator appointed to them, and therefore under court supervision and guidance and a court appointment, having their rights taken away from them. Currently, they're not necessarily, and in many instances, don't have legal counsel to represent them. Senate Bill 471, if that's passed and funded, and that is something that would achieve that in protection of their rights. So just trying to tie some dots together there for you. Hopefully that was helpful, and thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Mona Sanderson and the committee. My name's Allison Lindauer. I'm a nurse practitioner and researcher at the Leighton Aging and Alzheimer's Center up at OHSU. And my job today is to talk about one of SPADO's goals, which is to increase access to specialty care. And we currently have a research project started at OHSU that uses telemedicine to increase access to specialists at OHSU. And I want to thank you for your work on Senate Bill 144 to help us provide telemedicine care in Oregon. So Dr. Erton Lyons and I are the lead researchers on the project Alzheimer's Care via Telemedicine for Oregon, also known as ACT-ON, at the Leighton Center at OHSU. The aim of this project is to care for Oregonians living with Alzheimer's and their family caregivers using direct-to-home telemedicine video technology. ACT-ON is funded through the Oregon Health Authority's State Federal State Innovation Model. As you know, Oregon is facing a daunting challenge in addressing the needs of citizens with Alzheimer's disease. One concerning challenge is that access to expert care is limited to urban citizens because specialists such as myself and Dr. Erton Lyons tend to be located in metropolitan areas. Furthermore, cognitive and physical impairments related to Alzheimer's can make travel to clinic sites difficult regardless of distance, and there's a comment in your appendix about a family talking about this. These two issues converge into restricted access to specialty care for a substantial proportion of the 60,000 Oregonians with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. Through our research at OHSU, we aim to help families living with Alzheimer's by providing high-quality telemedicine care directly to the home. Currently, in order to receive telemedicine care, Medicare beneficiaries must live in a rural county and must drive to a Medicare-designated originating site, such as a hospital or clinic, to receive care. Citizens who are covered by Medicare cannot receive direct-to-home telemedicine care. Our study, the first of its kind in Oregon, will test the feasibility of direct-to-home Alzheimer's care. Telemedicine is cost-effective, saving both patients and providers time and money. In addition, telemedicine Alzheimer's care has the potential to delay skilled nursing home placement. By age 76, almost 50% of persons with Alzheimer's live in skilled care, pushing the annual national cost of dementia care to $150 billion. Research has shown that ongoing telephone support can reduce the rate of skilled nursing placement by 28%. For Oregon, this could translate into millions of dollars in savings. Our ACT-ON project advances SPADO's goals by increasing access to specialty care, but it will serve only 80 families. We will seek funding to maintain this program once our study is completed. And again, I just want to thank you for your support and the work you've done to advance telemedicine care in Oregon and for your attention this afternoon.
Very well organized presentation. You've covered some really key areas. Is there any comments?
I would just comment about the telemedicine piece, which makes me incredibly sad because we are, thanks to Senator Mona Sanderson and some great work she did in the interim, we've passed a bill in Oregon that makes it possible for people other than Medicare beneficiaries to get telemedicine services covered wherever they are. And regardless of your insurance status, it's a very effective way, and especially for Alzheimer's patients where getting them out of the house safely can be challenging, where they're more likely to open up and have a real conversation with their providers, whichever kinds of providers they are, where people who need subspecialty care, and especially even in urban areas, we have a provider shortage. And so I strongly support your efforts, and if there's anything we can do to help with that. I know our federal delegation is very interested in this issue, and it's really critically important. So thank you for the work you're doing to demonstrate the feasibility of this kind of care and the value to our communities. Really appreciate it.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We do appreciate your support.
Is there anyone else that's going to speak? Thank you so much. I'll close the informational hearing, and I think that Senator, we're going to relook at Senator Cruz's request to suspend the rules. You want to request that again?
Madam Chair, I would like to suspend the rules to allow me to vote on House Bill 2758A. It will not change the outcome.
Senator Cruz moves to suspend the rules to allow him to vote on House Bill 2758. Is there any opposition to this? Seeing none, how do you vote?
I vote no.
Note that Senator Cruz votes no on House Bill 2758A.
Madam Chair, I would like to reopen a work session, or if you hadn't had a work session, I would like to go into a work session on House Bill 3530A.
Okay, we are going to reopen or open a work session on House Bill 3530A.
Okay. Do you already do the explanation and all that earlier? Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 3530A.
Is that right?
The A2s. And threes.
And the threes.
And
yeah.
Threes.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A2 amendment to House Bill 3530A. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? It is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the A3 amendment to House Bill 3530A.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A3 amendments into House Bill 3530A. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3530A as amended by the A2 and A3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3530A as amended with the two A2s and the A3s. Is there any discussion? I'd like to just comment on a couple of things because I do want to give respect to those that were in opposition. And let me just pull my notes out here. I know that Mr. Cosgrove was worried about preventing discounts with providers and his ability to work on that. I'd like Nikki to just come up real briefly. Just to answer the question that I had regarding contract terms, do you really envision that the costs are going to go up if we implement this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nikki Terzieff again here for the Optometric Physicians Association. I believe the question is, do I envision that costs will go up if we pass this bill? And my answer is no.
Yes. Okay.
Brilliant.
That's a weird, that was a very to-the-point answer.
And how about credentialing? And I know they were worried about maintaining the network.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm not sure that I could speak to that.
Okay. All right. Do you want to go? Sure.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm representing the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. This will not prevent them from continuing to credential. Most of the credentialing right now goes through the medical health insurers who then contract with the vision insurers for just that vision element. So for the most part, it's done by the medical, but it wouldn't prevent, obviously, vision insurers from continuing to or from doing any credentialing. As to the costs, the only thing I would add is Kansas, which we use their model language, adopted this a year ago or sometime last year, and no cost increases. I think there are, you know, some, we talk about the cost shifting and what goes on and who's pushing the cost to whom. But in terms of any cost increases, there's no evidence, at least in Kansas, the one state that we modeled this bill after.
Any other questions regarding the concerns that were brought up? All right. If there's no further discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Motion carries. And who would like to carry this bill?
I will.
Okay, Senator Cruz will carry the bill. I will close the work session on House Bill 3530. Now, have we we don't need to carry anything over, or except for the one. We are carrying over 2638. Okay. With that, we're adjourned. 38. Okay. With that, we're adjourned. 26.